Hey, everybody. This is Sarah Krieger. I'm an emergency physician and intensivist at UCLA, and this is the ICU EDU podcast. Let's talk about resuscitation and the science of expertise. How do we become resuscitation experts? You know, resuscitology is an interesting subspecialty. There is a lot of knowledge you need to achieve excellence in just critical care. You know, I mean, you need to know vents, you need to know acid base, you need to know shock. But it's one thing to apply that knowledge when you're rounding calmly and quietly on the ICU. Applying that knowledge under the dual pressures of time and acuity, and often with the additional challenge of multiple simultaneous patients and incomplete information in a noisy environment, that just becomes a qualitatively different skill and requires a different approach to patient care and clinical decision making. I was reading this paper the other day, and it's a paper that got published a long time ago in Academic Emergency Medicine back in 1999. And it was talking about clinical decision making in the perspective of the emergency physician. And to quote from this paper, ACLS and ATLS provide the physician with an approach when acuity and time preclude the use of the hypothetico-deductive model as a clinical decision-making process. Anxiety generated by the, quote, crashing patient is addressed by such algorithms by allowing the clinician to fall back on protocol. And so this paper was basically like, look, when you have a sick, crashing, complicated, anxiety-provoking patient, it's a good idea to fall back on algorithms like ACLS and ATLS to sort of streamline your mental approach. Now, I totally agree that in order to be effective in high acuity situations where we need to make complex decisions quickly, we do need to find a way to streamline our mental processes. And one approach to that is by following arrows. You get an algorithm, you follow the arrows, and that gives you something to fall back on that feels very safe in a high stress situation. I would argue that there is an alternative way that we can, and I think probably should, be doing this. That resuscitation is a mental exercise that should more closely resemble speed chess than following an algorithm. And the way to accomplish that mental exercise is, in fact, expertise. Now, when I say things like that, that we should all be trying to achieve expertise, people are like, yeah, that sounds great, but actually, what on earth are you talking about? It sounds like a kind of squishy thing to say. I mean, what do I mean? That you show up at work and you're like, yep, hope I'm feeling smart today. No, that's actually not what I'm talking about. And it turns out that there is a science of expertise and that we've actually learned a lot from studying how elite chess players play speed chess, by studying how excellent mathematicians do what they do, how excellent athletes and even surgeons become experts. And there is a science of expertise that I think we can learn from when we're talking about becoming excellent resuscitationists. So the first thing we know from that science of expertise is that consistently and overwhelmingly, the evidence shows that experts are made, not born. We often talk about prodigies, people who are incredibly talented, but that's actually not how excellence seems to be obtained. And that doesn't matter what kind of task you're talking about. It can be music, chess, sports, or medicine. It doesn't even matter that much whether it's a mental versus physical task. Now, obviously, certain characteristics, like if you're trying to be a basketball player and you're 5'1", that probably matters. So, of course, certain innate characteristics matter to a point. But the science of expertise suggests to us strongly that that is not the critical determining factor in most kinds of expertise. Another critical piece that is common to experts in any area is not so much that they know more than non-experts, it's not they know it differently. Because expertise is not just about knowledge quantity. In fact, it's a lot more about knowledge quality and how people organize that knowledge. To quote from a book that came out in 2017, The Neuroscience of Expertise, one of the hallmarks of experts' outstanding performance is the use of qualitatively different cognitive strategies. These qualitatively different cognitive strategies are referred to as mental representations, or I prefer to call them mental models. And what's fascinating is that you can literally see them developing in somebody's brain as they obtain expertise. So when you look at fMRI studies of expertise, the brains of novices are activated quite differently from experts when confronted with a domain-specific problem. And then as expertise evolves, the brain literally changes and you start seeing different activation patterns during domain-specific problem solving. And what's notable if you look at these activation patterns is that expert brains are not just activated more than novice brains. It's not that more areas light up or light up more robustly in experts. They're activated differently. And as opposed to the larger areas of more diffuse activation you see in novices, in experts, you start seeing this smaller, different areas, but more confined activation in experts. To some extent, the focused activations you see in expert brains probably reflect another key characteristic of experts, their ability to reduce the complexity of the environment and separate the signal from the noise, to know not just what pay attention to, but what to ignore. Experts are faster and more efficient, not because they just are smarter and think faster, but it's because they employ strategic focus, where they can rapidly identify and focus all of their mental resources on the critical aspects of situations and disregarding the less important information. So, for example, this is something that we all do as attendings when we're listening to presentations from trainees. If a medical student starts giving you a presentation on headaches, you're going to be listening, and, you know, when they're describing the names of the patient's seven cats, you're maybe not listening that hard. But then when the medical student starts talking about, yeah, the patient said the headache was sudden onset, now, all of a sudden, you are focused, and you spend a disproportionate amount of time figuring out what sudden onset means to that headache. Exactly when was the onset? How did it happen? And so that is you employing an expert strategy, strategic focus. Now, this strategic focus becomes especially important in an environment like the ED or recess bay or ICU because there is a lot of noise that you need to wade through in order to find your signal. And sometimes that noise is literal. There's a million people in the room. They are actually yelling. But sometimes it's the noise of excess data. Because in the ICU especially, we have a million pieces of data, right? We get a million labs. We've pan scanned everybody. We have all of this information that we need to wade through. And sometimes we forget that the easiest way to hide something is not in a carefully designed hiding space, but in the middle of a lot of other similar things. My sister is a public defender, and she tells stories of how, you know, if the prosecution doesn't want to give them a piece of information that, you know, they're legally required to give, but they don't really want to give, what they'll do is, since they can't say, no, we're not going to give you that piece of information, they'll send over that piece of information on a piece of paper in a box with other pieces of paper and send it over with 50 other boxes. And so it's not that that piece of data is not there. It's that the best way to hide something is in the middle of a bunch of other similar things. And that is the situation we are sometimes dealing with in the ED or the ICU. The signal is there, but it's hidden amongst all of the other data that is being handed to us. Ultimately, the essence of expertise is all about mental model quantity and quality. It's all about those mental models of thinking about a problem differently, being able to ignore the less important information, focus on the more important information. And what's interesting about this is that you don't actually need an fMRI study. You can actually watch people developing these mental models as they learn, no fancy technology required. So my favorite study of expertise, one of the early studies of expertise that I like to describe, is a study where they talked this college kid into memorizing strings of numbers. And they were like, we're going to give you a year and you're supposed to memorize strings of numbers. And that, I don't know why they chose this particular thing. It doesn't sound all that awesome to me, but whatever, they got this kid to agree to do it. And he started out like most people. He was able to hear a string of seven numbers once and hold it in working memory and recite it. I mean, that's what most of us can do. That's why phone numbers are not coincidentally seven numbers. And then he went about teaching himself to memorize longer and longer and longer strings of numbers. And as you would expect, initially this sort of happened incrementally. He went from 7 to 10 to 15 to 20. That's not very interesting. But then, at some point, something very interesting happened. He made a leap. He went from maybe 22 to 50. All of a sudden, made this leap 22 to 50. And then after that, he continued to progress incrementally till eventually he could recite strings of 80 numbers after hearing them once. But that's not the interesting part. The interesting part is the leap. What happened right here when he had that leap from memorizing 20 numbers to all of a sudden going to 50 numbers? Right there, that was acquisition of a new mental model. And we can see this. We've all observed this, if we think about it, in ourselves and in our trainees, that it feels like you're not getting anywhere and you're kind of treading water and you're barely progressing. And then one day you're like, oh, wait a minute, they just improved very significantly. I didn't see that coming, but look, what did they just do? That leap was them acquiring a new mental model. But what about teaching expertise? That is an interesting question. Do we need everybody to show up and just hope they'll develop these mental models whenever they develop them or not, as the case may be? That's when the study of expertise got really interesting. So, if you go back to the guy who memorized all the numbers, he can now recite 80 numbers after hearing them once. And then they were like, okay, we want you to teach the next guy how to do it. And when the first guy who already had this skill went and taught somebody else to do it, that leap, that quantum learning leap, came sooner. It came faster. And so what I think we should really be doing as teachers, the way to think about it is we are trying to transmit our expert mental models. That's really our goal here if we're trying to create experts. The problem is that's often not the way that we teach people in medicine. For example, the way that I was taught acid-base, it felt like doing a lot of math to pass a test, and there were 17 steps and there were inexplicable graphs. That's not really how we should teach acid-base. That is not a mental model. What is a mental model of acid-base? My mental model of acid-base is saying acid-base status is an aggregate of multiple ongoing processes, and those processes can be depicted on a vector diagram. That is what I think of as a mental model of acid base, rather than asking somebody to follow 17 steps for no reason that they're aware of. And so when we talk about teaching expertise, what is required of us is not for us to try and teach people something the way that was taught to us. I mean, that's often what our temptation is, that if somebody's like, okay, teach me acid base, we teach it to them in the way that we were taught it, not in the way we actually do it. What we actually need to do instead is think about, how do I actually do this? How do I apply my expertise at the bedside and then deconstruct and back calculate it and then explain it to our trainees? Because what we should be trying to do when teaching medicine, I think, is not be training people to become a walking medical Wikipedia. You know, reciting the ACLS card from memory is not qualitatively different than reading it aloud off the card. And expertise, again, is not about having a huge body of knowledge and memorize a million things. Expertise is less defined by what you know and more defined by how you organize your thinking. It's like if you have a pile of clothes sitting in your closet. Good luck when you're getting up in the morning trying to access those clothes and find the favorite shirt, favorite socks, hat, and scarf to get out the door quickly that you need. But if you then buy one of those really fancy closet organization systems, the pile of clothes is organized in a really intelligent, thoughtful way. All of a sudden, you have access to using those clothes functionally in a way that you didn't before. And so expertise, less about what you know and more about how you organize that knowledge. So, for example, the H's and T's. Okay, so people have probably heard me go on rants before about how I really dislike mnemonics. Now, part of this is because I just cannot remember them. I really can't. Somebody asked me the other day, like, okay, what are the H's and T's again? And I was like, I don't even know. My excuse for this, that is probably partially real and partially an excuse, is that experts actually don't tend to use mnemonics. It turns out that experts are not actually better at memorization than non-experts. I mean, unless their area of expertise is, of course, memorization. But let's say you look at chess masters. So they can do this very impressive thing where they can glance at a chessboard and appear to memorize every single piece on the chessboard. And their apparent ability to memorize pieces on a chessboard is much more impressive, much more significant than what chess novices can do. But there's a catch. This seemingly miraculous ability to memorize a bazillion different pieces on a chessboard, they can only do it from a board that could occur in an actual chess game. If you just randomly place chess pieces on a board, experts in chess are actually not much better than memorizing the position of those pieces than novices. Because what they're expert at is not memorizing random things. They're experts at chess. They're experts at understanding the patterns that might occur on a chessboard. And similarly, with the H's and T's, there's no intrinsic relationship between words that start with the letter H or T to the differential diagnosis for cardiac arrest. And so somebody testing your ability to memorize a bunch of words that start with H and T has very little to do with your ability to generate a differential diagnosis for cardiac arrest. And so that's why for me, I just don't find mnemonics helpful. And so I actually just don't really use the H's and T's when I'm running a cardiac arrest. But I think there's a really important distinction here. Because I'm not saying that you should go up to a cardiac arrest and just trust yourself in this high-stress situation to hopefully spontaneously think of all the right things. That's actually not what I'm saying here. I really believe that there's a difference between being algorithmic and systematic, and we shouldn't be algorithmic, but we should be systematic. Because when we are in a high-stress situation, we should be able to fall back on systematic, organized, problem-solving approaches that we have thought through and practiced ahead of time. But I think that they should have something to do with the actual thing that we're doing rather than trying to memorize a list of random things. Because my ability to recall a list of random things under pressure versus my ability to fall back on a mental model, an organizational structure that actually makes sense related to the activity I'm engaging in, for me at least, that's a lot better. So for example, with cardiac arrest, instead of trying to recall the H's and T's, I instead say, okay, my systematic solving approach for cardiac arrest is, I'm going to put my cardiac arrest differential diagnosis into three categories, and I'm going to go through them every time I have a cardiac arrest patient. The three categories are respiratory, hemodynamic, and metabolic. For a respiratory problem, I break it down as, okay, is this an airway problem or a lung problem? When I'm thinking about hemodynamic category, I think about, okay, basically it's the same as my four categories of shock, cardiogenic, obstructive, hypovolemic, and distributive. And then for metabolic problems, I think about what are my most common metabolic issues, potassium, acidemia, glucose, or toxins. And so rather than memorizing a bunch of random things, I have a systematic problem-solving approach for cardiac arrest. I also think this helps you, specifically with cardiac arrest, is dealing with the problem of all of the arrows. Because if you look at the ACLS algorithm, there's a lot of arrows and sub-arrows, and then arrow B, go to the side of the card, and then there's subsection A. And dealing with all contingencies and critical situations does require a lot of arrows. But I think the problem with all the arrows is that sometimes it makes you miss the forest for the trees, and you get so caught up in all the arrows that you forget what you really need to be doing. And experts have a way of addressing this forest versus tree problem, which is called information chunking. I am basically going to chunk things into big boxes. I'm not going to focus on this arrow goes here and this arrow goes here. I'm going to focus on, okay, what are the big boxes? What are the big categories of things that I need to do? And chunking makes things manageable, even in a high-stress situation, because it really makes you realize there are not an infinite number of categories. In fact, there are probably very few of them. So, for example, in cardiac arrest, I actually would argue that most of us who are running a code actually already do it. We just don't know we do it. So when I'm running a code, the three boxes, so to speak, that I chunk things in are my three goals. 1, perfuse the brain. 2, identify and address reversible causes. And 3, reboot the heart. Now, I bet that a lot of you already do this when you're running a code. You're not pulling out your ACLS card and following the arrows. You already have these three categories somewhere in your head, and you're already basically thinking about it like this. But I find it helpful to make that explicit, not just to ourselves, but to the students we're teaching, because it's way easier to be systematic if our mental model is explicit. But in addition to mental models for things like cardiac arrest and a systematic approach to cardiac arrest, we also should have explicit mental models for clinical problem solving. So not just the content of the problem, like I need to know acid-base, but how we approach the clinical problem solving. And in a complex dynamic situation of a resuscitation where we need to be adaptive as we get more data and as the situation changes, this becomes particularly important. So an example of this is what I call rapid task switching. Particularly in emergency medicine, but certainly also in resuscitation and on ICU night shifts, we reference the idea of multitasking quite a bit. The problem is, multitasking doesn't really help a trainee conceptualize a specific skill that they can learn and then practice. Nor do I believe it's actually really the skill that you should be using. So instead of multitasking, I like instead to think about it and teach it the concept of rapid task switching. So, imagine you are trying to watch two different movies at the same time. Now, one approach to this is just to turn them on both simultaneously. And if you put them on both simultaneously and try and follow them both simultaneously, most likely you will have no idea what's actually going on. Instead, though, what if you do this? Practice the cognitive task sequence of pause, bookmark, switch. You start by watching movie number one. You watch movie one, number one. You are completely focused on movie number one. Then, when you get interrupted by movie number two, you pause movie number one, take a moment to mentally bookmark your spot, and then switch your full attention to movie number two. You start movie number two. Full attention on new movie number two. And then, when movie number one interrupts you again, you pause movie number two, you bookmark your place mentally, and you switch your attention back to movie number one. That rapid task switching, that pause bookmark switch strategy, is something that I find much more effective, and it's something that you and your trainees can literally practice at home with literal movies if you want to, but also on shift. It's a cognitive strategy you can practice. Another cognitive strategy that I like to talk about more in the ICU with really complicated patients or in resuscitations with really complicated patients is this idea that we have of coming to a correct diagnosis versus a wrong diagnosis. And if only it were that simple, but it's often not. Instead of the, did I get the correct diagnosis? Instead, I think we should be practicing very explicitly a cognitive strategy called iterative hypothesis testing, where it's not a yes, no, right, wrong, black, white. It's a process that you go through where you gather data, you revise your hypothesis, you adjust management, you gather more data, adjust your hypothesis, and then adjust management again. And it's this cyclical thing. And explicitly doing that while I'm taking care of a sick patient, I have found to be a much more effective clinical mental model for problem solving that patient than just saying, is the diagnosis correct or wrong? A holy grail element of expertise is the peak performance seen during flow states. When we see experts doing things that seem mentally or physically impossible, like playing 10 simultaneous games of chess, or elite soccer players knowing exactly where to be and exactly where the ball is, or climbing El Capitan, it's not magic, it's a flow state. This is when expertise culminates in this state of optimal performance, where you see this beautifully smooth and accurate task execution associated with subjective experience of just this complete absorption in the task to the point of lack of awareness of time passing and lack of awareness of even of yourself. And it's been described in the literature and everything from sports to music to surgery to even video gaming and business negotiations. And I think that most of us have probably experienced it in some context, whether that's in your life in medicine or in other things you do like sports or music. But it turns out, unsurprisingly, that flow states become especially important in fields that involve critical tasks under time pressure. and fortunately are actually more likely to occur during these critical tasks. Sports, for example, especially the high consequence ones such as climbing. And this is particularly interesting because another characteristic of flow states, neurobiologically and subjectively, are the relatively low levels of stress experienced in the moment, even when objectively it's a very high stress moment. Now, a key determinant of the ability to experience a flow state is the match between the person's skills and the task challenges. And flow states are most easily accessed when the skills and the challenges are both high and sort of balance each other. Now, interestingly, this concept sort of dovetails with studies of leadership, some of them done in the military, that find that team stress levels are lowest when the team leader perceives the task as a challenge that they want to take on instead of a threat, and then makes the assessment that there is a good match of needs and resources to meet that challenge. Now, in medicine, I think that carries over, that if you view whatever task comes into you, if it's a sick code coming in, and as they're wheeling in that cardiac arrest patient or that trauma patient, are you nervous because you see this task being presented with you as a threat to your knowledge, as a threat to you not being able to save the patient, as a threat to you looking bad in front of your team? Or do you welcome it, bring it on as a challenge that you have the resources to meet? And when we talk about resources in medicine, yeah, we could talk about, do you have access to an ECMO team? But I don't really think that's what it's about. I think most of the time, the most important resource that we're talking about is you, your mental abilities, your expertise, your ability to do procedures, your mental models. And this is why we need to work to attain resuscitation expertise. Now, on our journey to attaining it, it's not totally straightforward. We would like to think that it's one of those practice makes perfect things, right? Like you heard that during music lessons all throughout when you were a kid. The idea of the 10,000 hour rule, where if you just do something over and over and over again, you'll eventually get really good at it. And again, if it were only that simple. Turns out it's not. Most people, what they do is they practice in a relatively inefficient way, and then they eventually get to a state of acceptable performance, and then they sort of peter off. But it turns out there's a way to practice better. And I like to think about it as slow is smooth and smooth is fast. So I used to be a musician before I went into medicine. And when you're practicing a really difficult passage from a really difficult piece that goes really fast, what you don't do is practice it messily as fast as possible. What you instead do is practice it very, very slowly and perfectly over and over and over again. And you get it just right every time until it slowly becomes fast. But you can do that for mental processes as well. Don't just kind of throw off a bunch of orders when you see a chest pain patient or see a septic patient and be like, 30 cc's per kilo, I'm done. Practice thinking about this patient the right way. Practice thinking over and over again, making sure that your thought patterns are correct. Do it slowly. Take the time you have protected as a trainee to do this slowly, and then you're going to perfect those thought patterns. You're going to perfect your mental models of pathophysiology, and eventually it becomes very fast, but not because you're trying to practice it fast, but because you're trying to practice it slowly and smoothly. The name for the way that we probably should be practicing is not the do it many, many times, but the deliberate practice approach. So deliberate practice is a particular way of learning a skill and increasing your expertise in an area. So deliberate practice involves three different aspects: goals, focus, and feedback. So the first is goals. You need to set a very specific goal. And getting better at medicine is not really it. So maybe your specific goal is, I need to get better with my wire management skills during invasive lines. Then you need to focus on that skill. So when you're like, okay, I'm going to pick up the wire, You're not just like, I'm going to pick up the wire. You're like, okay, I need to focus on one. When I pick up that wire, I'm making sure there's not gel or blood on my hands first so that it's not slippery. Two, I'm going to place my thumb exactly right here, and that's the best place for me to roll the wire smoothly. Three, I'm going to have the J oriented just like this, and so forth and so on. So you're not just like, I'm going to focus on my wire skills. You're going to be like, okay, I'm breaking it down into the key components that I'm going to use to focus on my wire skills. And then feedback. You have to be open to critical feedback from yourself and everybody else. Feedback is not an opportunity for you to feel bad or look bad. That is not what this is about. It is the only way to get better and get better quickly. And so feedback from an expert who already knows how to do the task, and you have to be open to taking that feedback. Because feedback like, you did a great job, makes you feel good, but is not particularly helpful. Be asking them specifically for, I'm working on my wireman manage skills. Watch me manage my wire. Give me feedback. What did I do right? What did I do wrong? How can I make it better? But you can also do this kind of deliberate practice for mental tasks. So maybe your mental task is, okay, I am going to get better at how I think about cardiac arrest. I'm going to watch myself during a cardiac arrest. And okay, I'm going to specifically work on my differential diagnosis skills. Okay, so here is my systematic thing. Oh, you know what? I wasn't being systematic enough. I'm going to make sure you're going to practice being systematic, even if I think I know what the problem is, and even if it's a high stress situation, and then have somebody watching you and get feedback. Yeah, you were doing pretty good being systematic, but then when it got to the place that, you know, five more people came in and we couldn't get a line, you got flustered and distracted and you fell off your systematic approach, for example. So I think that every single shift we should be going to, we should be practicing deliberately. I try and do it every day because I feel like on most shifts, there is at least a moment that I'm like, oh, I'm a moron. I didn't know that thing, or I didn't do that as well as I could have. And try and engage in deliberate practice myself as much as possible to make myself better. So those are some thoughts on how the science of expertise can inform our ability to master resuscitation. And if you think about the amount of time that we spend on various things in medicine, the amount of time we spend reading new literature, the amount of time we spend going to journal club, learning all the new algorithms and guidelines, the amount of time that we spend learning about the newest technologies and devices, I would say that we should be investing just as much time on improving our mental model, quantity and quality. Now, it's not that I think algorithms are useless necessarily. I think in certain areas of medicine, they make a lot of sense. And for me, they make a lot of sense in areas where I'm not an expert. So if I'm thinking about pediatric fever or basically anything orthopedic related, I am following the algorithm because I am not an expert in that area. And in general, I think that algorithms can be useful places to start, but not a place to end in your area of expertise. And I think it's particularly problematic when we say that algorithms should be replacing our thinking in areas of expertise. At the end of the day, I think that one of the most important reasons that we should be trying to become experts and teaching ourselves to think about medicine in the right way is that, as we learned with COVID, we're not going to have algorithms, guidelines, papers for everything. You can't prophylactically make a guideline or an algorithm for a condition you don't know exists yet. And not to mention that, by definition, we won't have evidence on said new condition when it happens. And with COVID, what it really took was being expert in how to think and how to solve problems in medicine, knowing enough about respiratory physiology and ventilators that you could work through these problems in real time before we had enough information to give us an algorithm at all. So I would say expertise in resuscitation, in critical care, in emergency medicine is something we should actively be cultivating in ourselves. And we should also be cultivating in our trainees. Thanks so much for listening.